The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 28, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in white, superimposed upon a pale gray, almost an pale ice blue background. This is the papal edition. The making of the Pope is a caption on the cover, as we see a woman dressed very stylishly as if going to church, and she's wearing a suit, high-heeled pumps, a fur piece, and a beautiful picture frame or picture type hat with the large brim. She has dark eyes. Her dark hair is pulled back from her face, and she is smiling at the camera. In front of her stand three little boys. The oldest and tallest is wearing long pants, dark shoes, a light-colored jacket under which there is a flowered or figured shirt because the lapels of the shirt are neatly placed upon the jacket lapels. Then there's a second child. He's wearing short pants, a white shirt again with those nicely starched lapels over a striped jacket, dark shoes and striped socks to match the jacket, and the youngest. Now, the two older boys are grinning at the camera, not exactly smiling, but grinning, and the littlest guy is looking very seriously ahead at the camera. He's holding something in his hand, perhaps an envelope or a prayer card. He, too, is wearing short pants, dark shoes, striped socks, a striped jacket, and the same starched white collar lapel. And the youngest of the group is Robert Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV. Beginning with the text for today, The Risk Report by Ion Bremmer, contributing editor. The 2015 migrant crisis still hangs over Europe. The more than 1.3 million migrants, particularly from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, who claimed asylum that year, have been a boon for grievance-driven European populism and its most talented practitioners. The upshot is a cultural and economic anxiety that's transformed the continent's political landscape. And yet the first 10 years of the far right's rise have amounted to a yes-but decade. In Germany, the Alternative for Germany party has steadily expanded its regional and federal influence, but all other major parties still treat political collaboration with it as taboo. In France, the populist Marine Le Pen has shown she can reach the second round of presidential elections, but has been unable to claim victory. In Italy, Giorgia Meloni in 2022 became the first anti-immigrant populist to win a big European election. But her strong cooperation with Brussels and consistent support for Ukraine have helped her defy far-right stereotypes. In the UK, Brexit champion Nigel Farage might now be polling in first place, but that is still some distance from winning the next general elections in 2029. centrist governments have also emerged this year after elections in Germany and Romania, despite a rise in support for the far right. Meanwhile, the Dutch government, led by the far right Party for Freedom, collapsed in June, and the Austrian Freedom Party has failed to form a ruling coalition, despite winning elections in September. For now, EU institutions are holding up fine. Pro-EU parties continue to dominate politics in Brussels, and the risk that Eurosceptics can create gridlock remains low. In the European Parliament, the centrist coalition that backed Ursula von der Leyen for a second term as European Commission President will hold together despite growing tensions. In the European Council, just 4 of 27 members, Hungary, Slovakia, Italy, and the Czech Republic, are led by nationalist governments. But Brussels has finally managed to limit the ability of far-right governments to shift EU policies, and Meloni and Czech Prime Minister Petr Fiala cooperate closely with von der Leyen. All that said, the next few years will offer big opportunities from Europe's anti-immigrant, Eurosceptic far right. Questions about economic resilience and stubbornly high prices remain the main sources of economic anxiety for voters, even as immigration policies have been tightened and the number of asylum seekers in Europe has fallen. The long-term presence of migrants amid stagnating economies will continue to feed voter anger. The economic pressures applied by Donald Trump's trade war compound public frustration with their current governments. In short, there's no reason to believe far-right parties and politicians will fall silent or fail to score future political gains at the expense of beleaguered centrist establishments. 2 years from now, far-right parties will have their best-ever shot at capitalizing on mounting voter anger with national elections in France, Italy, Spain, and Poland. In France, though Le Pen is currently barred from seeking the presidency following an embezzlement conviction in March, her National Rally Party could finally sweep to power in the heart of Europe. In Italy, Meloni will face pressure to adopt more Eurosceptic positions on high-profile issues in the run-up to elections. In Spain, the center-right Popular Party will likely lead the next government, but could be forced to welcome the far-right Vox into a coalition for the first time. In Poland, steadily eroding support for Prime Minister Donald Tusk could pave the way for a return of right-wing nationalist parties to power there. The far-right Karol Nawrocki has already prevailed in the June presidential elections, and he will take office in August. Taken together, these developments would shift the balance of power in the populists' favor, transforming how the EU defines its values and its interests. The potential fallout, whether on the rule of law, security, and economic matters, internal borders, dealing with an expansionist Russia, or even the future of the EU itself, remains grave. There's a small inset photo here, titled or captioned, European Leaders at a Summit in London, March 2. Well, there are approximately 16, most of them in dark suits and white shirts and ties, most of them men, but I'm counting 3 women, one of whom is Ursula von der Leyen of the European Parliament, and she's dressed in black and coral. Turning the page to the View inbox, Health Matters by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. In A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge at first dismisses the ghosts that torment him as mere dietary disturbances. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato, he says to one spectral visitor. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are. Cartoonist Winsor McCay made his name in the early 20th century with Dreams of the Rarebit Fiend, in which protagonists suffer bizarre dreams and nightmares they attributed to eating Welsh rarebit, a delicacy of spiced cheese on toast. A modest body of contemporary research has sought to explore the link between food and nightmares more empirically. The latest, a study in the journal Frontiers in Psychology, finds that if you want to get your Z's, you'd best limit the cheese. To conduct the study, Tora Nielsen, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Montreal, and colleagues surveyed 1,082 students at McEwen University in Alberta. All completed a questionnaire about their diet, food sensitivities, sleep habits, dream recall, and more. The students reported how late in the evening they eat, whether they regularly snack without feeling hungry, and if they have any gastrointestinal symptoms, food allergies, or diet-related conditions such as lactose intolerance. They also reported how well they sleep and how often their sleep is disturbed by nightmares. About 25% of the subjects said eating certain foods before bed seemed to worsen their sleep, while just over 20% said some foods improved their sleep. Of the people who reported having more nightmares after eating certain foods, 31% attributed the bad dreams to consumption of desserts and other sweets, 22% pointed to dairy, 16% cited meats, and 13% blamed spicy foods. The most commonly cited medical condition linked to sleep quality was lactose intolerance, lending legitimacy to Scrooge's crumb of cheese charge. Of the people who believed their diet was related to worse sleep overall, 30% were lactose intolerant. Nightmares are worse for lactose intolerant people who suffer severe gastrointestinal symptoms and whose sleep is disrupted, said Nielsen in a statement. This makes sense because we know other bodily sensations can affect dreaming. One 2024 meta-analysis, for example, found all manner of sensory experiences, including sounds, smells, flashing lights, physical pressure, and pain, can be incorporated into dreams when people are sleeping and investigators provide the stimulus. Food-related nightmares might also be linked to depression and anxiety, the researchers say. Lactose intolerance symptoms like bloating, cramping, and gas directly affect mood, which can carry over into sleep, powering bad dreams. The paper cites an earlier 2005 study by Nielsen showing dreaming is more emotionally intense and conflictual when abdominal cramping is at its worst, including during menstruation. When people eat can make a difference, too. Eating late in the evening or snacking till bedtime is linked to an eveningness chronotype, essentially being a night owl, which by itself has been associated with nightmares in earlier cited studies, and not all foods are bad for sleep. Close to 18% of people who regularly eat fruits reported better sleep, along with 12% of people who consume a lot of vegetables and 13% of people who drink herbal tea. The researchers concede their current work does not establish causation, with at least the possibility existing that bad dreams and poor sleep may lead to equally poor dietary habits rather than the other way around. We would like to run a study, Nielsen said, in which we ask people to ingest cheese products versus some control food before sleep to see if this alters their sleep or dreams. Time Off Movies, a review by Stephanie Zakarik, a wigged-out modern Western stuffed with ideas. How many times have you heard the expression, the pandemic broke our brains, particularly in less densely populated parts of America? Plenty of people still hold a grudge over the way life was shut down. In some places, mask wearing is still treated as a sign of wimpiness, and the lost years of Zoom education overshadow the reality that COVID-19 killed a lot of people, and that some who survived still suffer. The pandemic is the global event we just cannot let go, a scapegoat for people's anger over how and why their lives are not exactly as they would like. How did we get here? That's the question writer-director Ari Aster's somber comedy western Eddington appears to be asking. The story opens in late May 2020. It is set in the fictional city of Eddington, New Mexico, where the local sheriff, Joaquin Phoenix's Joe Cross, tools around responding to minor crises. He adores his wife, Emma Stone's emotionally fragile Louise, who whiles away her days making whimsically creepy dolls. Her overbearing mother, Dawn, Deirdre O'Connell, has moved in, a figurative suitcase of conspiracy theories in tow. Joe is stressed at home and annoyed at work. You get the sense he's ready to blow. The only thing he hates more than mask mandates is the town's sanctimonious mayor, Ted Garcia, Pedro Pascal, who's up for re-election. Ted is promising a tech-positive future, but he's the kind of guy who will put his stamp on anything he thinks will make him look good, and it's easy to see why he drives Joe crazy. In a fit of pique one day, Joe decides to run for mayor himself. He decorates his sheriff mobile like a circus wagon, adorned with signs that say things like, "You're being manipulated," and he proceeds to annoy and destroy his opponent, who's such a glad-handing windbag you don't mind seeing him taken down a peg. One of Ted's campaign ads shows him laughing and smiling with random black citizens in numbers larger than the city's actual black population. But Joe's droll swagger cannot hide the fact he is falling apart. Louise has fallen under the spell of a self-help guru, played by a buttery-smooth Austin Butler. It does not help she and Ted may have a sexual history. Just as Joe launches his campaign, George Floyd's murder spurs national protests, and not even little Eddington is spared. Eddington is an intelligent, questioning movie, but Aster packs in too much. He jabs at the sometimes questionable veracity of recovered memory syndrome. He's annoyed, justifiably, by activists with good intentions whose pious bullying can drive you away from a cause. The plot spirals into murder and mayhem. It takes too much time to wrap up, and when it does, its meaning is anyone's guess. As a filmmaker, Aster is two parts visionary to one part irritant. He can translate his ideas into evocative visuals. In his terror around the maypole reverie, Midsummer, Florence Pugh wears a flower crown of breathing, sentient flowers. The effect's creepy and beautiful at once. Beau Is Afraid is an ode to human neuroses in movie form, and if it's wearisome, its opening sequence is wickedly brilliant, a shaggy dog roundelay in which a hapless New Yorker, Phoenix, encounters the worst Manhattan has to offer. Astor has so many ideas he does not know when to stop, but he's observant about the way humans interact and about their tendency to let their fears and insecurities rule them. He is clear-eyed about the ways even well-meaning people can do horrible things when pushed to their breaking point, and the score by the Haxan Cloak and Daniel Pemberton is wonderful, with sweeping passages of Elmer Bernstein, like jauntiness. If this modern Western does not quite work, it's at least the very least a cry of vexation over what our country has become, thanks to a virus that found its way into not just our lungs, but our very lifeblood. Dr. Astor has listened to America's heartbeat. The diagnosis is that we're basically a mess. Time Off Movies. Essay, Clueless and the Art of an Open-Hearted Outlier by Stephanie Zakarik. How do you measure the worth of a filmmaker's career? Do you tick off box office returns or the awards lined up on a shelf? Which is a better determination of success, a string of hits or a film that lives on in the cultural imagination for decades and counting? Or how about this? Can you measure a career in terms of generosity of spirit? Writer-director Amy Heckerling's Clueless turns 30 this summer, and if she had made no other movies, this delightful modern reimagining of Jane Austen's Emma would have been an accomplishment by itself. Alicia Silverstone's Cher, a Beverly Hills high school student with a closet of riotous and costly mix-and-match outfits, and a knack for negotiating higher grades without actually earning them, comes off as shallow and spoiled. But there is a kindness and decency there, too. She tries her hand at matchmaking, at first to further her own aims, only to realize she likes bringing people together. She's too pragmatic to want love for herself until she's forced to acknowledge she has fallen for the guy she had always thought of as an annoying brother figure, Paul Rudd's Josh, the son of her father's ex-wife. Clueless is both original, credit Heckerling with bringing the phrase as if into the lexicon, and expertly crafted. Its smart, breezy gags are strung together as gracefully as a strand of pearls. It also shows great affection for its characters, even while mocking them gently. When Cher refers to one of the great sword and sandal epics as Sporadicus, you love her more, not less. She's not demeaning movies and experiences that are unfamiliar to her. She's just so eager, she bungles some of the specifics. That is the Heckerling touch, the mark of a filmmaker who's always led with confidence rather than ego, which is why the industry, incapable of grasping the difference between the two, never knew what to make of her, not even after she'd made one of the greatest teen movies of the 1980s, if not all time, 1982's Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Maybe it takes an outlier to make comedies that endure, as Clueless and Fast Times have, and maybe the lesson of Heckerling's checkerboard career is not that today's fractured world of filmmaking needs more people who know how to play the game. It is that we need more outliers who play on their own terms. Today we regularly and openly champion women filmmakers to the point where it can feel performative, but Heckerling and a small group of her contemporaries like her friend, Joan Micklin Silver, who had self-financed her first film, the marvelous Immigrant in New York story, Hester Street, 1975, were striving to make films when women directors were still treated as interlopers, not to be trusted with big studio budgets. At 28, the Bronx-born Heckerling, a graduate of New York University with a master's in film from the American Film Institute, made her feature debut with Fast Times, adapted from Cameron Crowe's book about teenage life in a Southern California high school. Fast Times was like no other teen movie at the time, particularly for the unvarnished way it presented teen pregnancy and abortion. Universal, the studio behind the film, nearly backed off when early test audiences responded negatively to that abortion subplot. The executives eventually relented, and Fast Times did well enough at the box office that Heckerling got to make two more films in quick succession, 1984's gangster spoof, Johnny Dangerously, which did not make money, and 1985's National Lampoon's European Vacation, which did. But Heckerling's biggest hit would be the 1989 comedy Look Who's Talking, starring Kirstie Alley as a single mother whose son, first as an infant, then as a toddler, wisecracks like a sailor on shore leave, though only the audience can hear it. Bruce Willis provides the kid's voice. The gimmick looks broad on paper, but the movie's both fun and stealthily forthright, a mischievously sympathetic film about a modern mom trying to hold it all together by herself. Sometimes the best way to deal with the most serious subjects is to treat them like a lark. Next, Heckerling took on one of the movie's two sequels, 1990's Look Who's Talking 2. Clueless would arrive 5 years later, but as adored as the film is today, it was only a moderate hit at the time. Heckerling's language has always been the mainstream comedy, a surefire way to get the guys at the top to take you seriously, which may explain why, since Clueless, she's never had the career she deserved. Her last feature was 2012's amiable horror comedy Vamps, starring Silverstone and Kristen Ritter as vampire girls who strive to hang on to their vampirific youth. They feast only on rat's blood, rather than be forced to age like humans. Since then, Heckerling's worked in television, directing episodes of Gossip Girl and Amazon Prime's Red Oaks, and has now turned Clueless into a musical, now playing in the London's West End. But let us track back to the idea of what it means to get the career you deserve. That is what happens when you deliver profits to executives. But what if you've made good or even terrific movies that have simply failed to land? Heckerling's so-called failures are better movies with more heart than many other comedy directors' successes. In the 2000 Loser, Jason Biggs plays Paul, a sweet but unhip Midwestern kid who gets a scholarship to NYU, only to be met with the sneering savagery of his rich kid roommates. His crush, Mina Savari's spiky, perceptive Dora, is involved with one of her professors, a weaselly Greg Kinnear. Loser's sharp and unyielding when it comes to human cruelty and boorishness. As always, Heckerling reserves her scrappy tenderness for the characters who deserve it. You really see that affection in 2007's I Could Never Be Your Woman, a film that, thanks to distribution rights issues beyond Heckerling's control, was never released in U.S. theaters, going straight to DVD. Michelle Pfeiffer plays Rosie, a writer and producer on a TV show about entitled but seemingly average teenagers. Heckerling based the movie on her own experience adapting Clueless into a television series in the late 1990s. Rosie's in her mid-40s and divorced with an 11-year-old daughter, Saoirse Ronan, in her film debut. She has not dated in forever. Then a new actor, Paul Rudd's late 20-something Adam, signs on for her show. She's reluctantly attracted to him. Is she too old? Is he too young? Most men would not entertain those questions for long, but they hit Rosie hard. Pfeiffer vests Rosie's self-doubt with effervescent energy. There's no need to feel sorry for her, but you cannot help wanting the best for her. Though Paramount had initially bought the script for I Could Never Be Your Woman, the studio declined to make the movie. There was some concern about doing a movie with an older female protagonist, not everybody's favorite demographic, Heckerling told Entertainment Weekly in 2008. She went with an independent producer, which is where the movie's distribution woes began. Today it's easy to stream if you seek it out, though relatively few people even know it exists. And that's how a brisk, intelligent movie ends up languishing. It could happen to anyone, and it happened to Heckerling. In the early 2000s, when many of us were complaining about the lack of smart romantic comedies for adults, this picture, one with charm and bite, was hiding in plain view. Now, at a time when the big studio theatrical release barely exists, it's like a shining relic from a lost era. If this is what you leave behind when you have not had the career you deserve, maybe that just means you've made a series of right choices. Anyone who thinks of them as wrong turns is the real loser. In the Loop by Billy Perigo, correspondent. Recent developments in AI could mean human-caused pandemics are 5 times more likely than they were just a year ago, according to a study of top experts. The data echo concerns raised in recent months by AI companies, OpenAI and Anthropic, both of which have warned today's AI tools are reaching the ability to meaningfully assist bad actors attempting to create bioweapons. It's long been possible for biologists to modify viruses using laboratory technology. The new development is the ability for chatbots like ChatGPT or Claude to give accurate troubleshooting advice to amateur biologists trying to create a deadly bioweapon in a lab. Safety experts have long viewed the difficulty of this troubleshooting process as a significant bottleneck on the ability of terrorist groups to create a bioweapon, says Seth Donahue, a co-author of the study. Now, he says, thanks to AI, the expertise necessary to intentionally cause a new pandemic could become accessible to many, many more people. Between December 2024 and February 2025, the Forecasting Research Institute asked 46 biosecurity experts and 22 super forecasters, individuals with a high success rate at predicting future events, to estimate the risk of a human-caused pandemic. The average survey respondent predicted the risk of that happening in any given year was 0.3%. Crucially, the surveyors then asked another question. How much would that risk increase if AI tools could match the performance of a team of experts on a difficult virology troubleshooting test? If AI could do that, the average expert said, then the annual risk would jump to 1.5%, a five-fold increase. What the forecasters did not know was that Donahue A. I'm going to spell that. It's D-O-N-O-U-G-H-E, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing it correctly. A research scientist at the pandemic prevention nonprofit Secure Bio was testing AI systems for that very capability. In April, Donahue's team revealed the results of those tests. Today's top AI systems can outperform PhD-level virologists at a difficult troubleshooting test. In other words, AI can now do the very thing forecasters warned would increase by a factor of 5 the risk of a human-caused pandemic. And that last sentence is in bold. The Forecasting Research Institute plans to resurvey the same experts in the future to track whether their view of the risks has increased as they said it would. To be sure, there are a few reasons to be skeptical of the results already at hand. Forecasting is an inexact science, and it is especially difficult to accurately predict the likelihood of very rare events. Also, forecasters in the study revealed a lack of understanding of the rate of AI progress. Most said they did not expect AI to surpass human performance at the virology test till after 2030, while Donahue's test showed that that bar had already been met. But even if the numbers themselves are taken with a pinch of salt, the authors of the paper argue the results as a whole still point in an ominous direction. It does seem near-term AI capabilities could meaningfully increase the risk of a human-caused epidemic, says Josh Rosenberg, CEO of the Forecasting Research Institute. Ukraine's Lost Children by Simon Schuster. Russia took thousands of Ukrainian kids. Can peace talks bring them home? Vladimir Putin could not make out the names of the missing children that appeared on the screen in front of him. They were printed in tiny letters, 339 in all, each representing a child abducted from the war zone in Ukraine, and according to authorities in Kyiv, forcibly taken to Russia. Putin had never been confronted with the list in public, and he showed no particular interest in reading it. It was June 4, a warm day in Moscow, exactly 3 years, 3 months, and 11 days since Putin ordered the invasion of Ukraine. In keeping with the habit of reclusiveness that he's cultivated during the war, the Russian president convened a meeting of his aides and ministers that day via video call. Their somber faces appeared in little boxes on his screen while Putin sat at his desk alone. They had a lot on their agenda. 3 days earlier, the war had spilled across the breadth of Russia as the Ukrainians smuggled a fleet of cheap drones across the border and used them to attack several military airfields, damaging or destroying Russian warplanes worth billions of dollars. The next day, Ukraine and Russia held another round of peace talks in Istanbul. Putin now wanted to know how they'd gone, and he called on his lead negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, to give the highlights. About 2 minutes into his report, Medinsky reached for the list of children he had received from the Ukrainians in Istanbul. "These so-called kidnapped children," he said, "they were saved by our soldiers, evacuated under fire." Leafing through the list of names, he added, "We'll have to figure out how many of them are here with us." Putin gave no response, and the meeting moved on to other issues. Outside Russia, the abduction of these children is widely seen as a war crime. For the Kremlin, it did not seem like an urgent matter. Indeed, over the past few months, the children's fate has been pushed to the edges of the peace process, intensifying fears across Ukraine that they may never come home. The longer they remain in Russia, the more difficult it will be to return and reintegrate them as the effect of Russian propaganda and indoctrination takes hold over time. In one case, an 11-year-old boy named Serhili refused to speak to his relatives in Ukraine after spending only a few months in Russian foster care. They completely brainwashed him, his older sister, Ksenia Koldin, told me after she managed to bring him home. They convinced him Ukraine had been destroyed, that he would starve if he went back. Since the start of the war, about 1,200 of the abducted children have returned to Ukraine, thanks mostly to the dogged efforts of their relatives and humanitarian aid organizations. Ukraine's envoys in Istanbul asked the Russians to return an additional 339 of them, hoping the Kremlin would see it as a simple way to build trust and show goodwill in the peace talks. But in total, the authorities in Kyiv say 19,546 children still need to be returned. An independent research group at Yale University has spent the past 3 years tracking them through Russian news reports, public databases, and posts on social media, identifying more than 8,400 children who've been systematically relocated from Ukraine. The Trump administration, as part of its broader suspension of foreign aid, cut off funding to the program in March. It has continued operating with help from private donors. In a statement published shortly after the suspension of aid, the U.S. State Department said President Donald Trump would continue to work with Russia and Ukraine to help make sure those children were returned home. But some U.S. diplomats have urged Ukraine not to make the ceasefire talks with Russia conditional on the children's return. You cannot set conditions if you want to move forward, one of them told me this spring, and Trump wants to move fast. Still in talks with Trump over the past few months, President Volodymyr Zelensky has repeatedly brought up the missing children, as have lawmakers on Capitol Hill. A bipartisan group of senators proposed a resolution in May calling for the return of all Ukrainian children before any peace deal with Russia is finalized. We wanted to make sure that it was part of the discussions, says Senator Roger Wicker, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who co-sponsored the resolution. Vladimir Putin should be in prison with the other notorious war criminals of history, Wicker told me, and it's a shame that we're not coming down on him as forcefully as we should. There's a photo here of a rather charming-looking white two-story building among many trees that are defoliated in this photo. In front are fallen leaves. This is in the front lawn of this large building. A swing set, a slide, and a merry-go-round that you push, you know, when the other children are on it. And the caption reads, "In the front-line city of Kherson, an orphanage is now mostly empty." Returning to the text, so far the strongest pressure on Putin to return the children has come from The Hague. In March 2023, about a year into the Russian invasion, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against Putin for unlawful transfer of Ukrainian children to Russia. As an indicted war criminal, Putin faces the risk of arrest whenever he travels to one of the 125 countries that recognize the jurisdiction of the ICC, including all of South America, nearly all of Europe, and roughly half of Africa. One of Putin's longtime associates in Moscow told me the indictment continues to irk the Russian president, Of course it's not comfortable for him, to put it mildly, to have these restrictions, threats of arrest, and so on. But he has gotten used to the isolation, and he feels no urgency to act on any of Ukraine's demands. He could spit on The Hague. He might give the children back as part of some humanitarian exchange. He's not Stalin, but honestly, it's just not a high priority. In Russian state media, the adoption and re-education of Ukrainian children is often portrayed as an act of charity and patriotism. The Kremlin Commissioner for Children's Rights, Maria Lvova-Belova, bragged in a televised meeting with Putin in 2023 that she had herself adopted a teenage boy from Ukraine. "It's thanks to you," she told Putin. The only other Russian official indicted by the ICC is Lvova-Belova, who faces the same war crime charges as Putin. During the recent talks in Istanbul, Putin's envoys at least acknowledged the issue of the missing children and promised to address it. "We will work on every one of the names in this list," Medinsky, the lead Russian negotiator, said after the talks on June 2. But he could not resist taking a jab at Ukrainians for demanding their children back. He compared the effort to a scene from Wag the Dog, in which a Hollywood producer helps the White House invent a war. The producer, played by Dustin Hoffman, at one point creates a fake video of a girl running through the ruins of a fabricated war. "If you want to get people crying, show them a lost child, ideally one holding a kitten," Medinsky said. "So that's what they're showing us." Of all the children on the list Putin saw, perhaps the best documented case is that of Margarita Prokopenko, who was only a few months old when the Russian invasion began. Abandoned at birth by her mother, Margarita was the youngest of several dozen children living in a home for orphans and kids with disabilities in the city of Kherson. In early March 2022, Russian troops overran that city and installed a puppet government to run it. Many of those who showed open resistance to the occupation were arrested or killed. A member of the Russian parliament, Igor Kostyukovich, soon arrived from Moscow to help cement the Kremlin's control, and he began making frequent visits to the orphanage that spring. Kostyukovich, who represents Putin's political party, would often arrive in the company of armed men dressed in camouflage and bring food and other supplies for the children, according to videos he posted online to document the visits. Early that fall, Kostyukovich and other Russian officials began taking the children away, they said, to ensure their safety. Margarita, the youngest, was among the first. According to Ukrainian investigators, the girl ended up in the custody of a prominent Putin ally named Sergei Mironov, who's been a fixture of Russia's ruling elite for over a quarter century. When we first met in Moscow in 2010, Mironov served as chairman of the upper house of parliament, representing Fair Russia, one of the sham opposition parties that the Kremlin uses to create the illusion of competitive politics. With the start of the invasion in 2022, Mironov dropped the charade and became one of the shrillest cheerleaders for Putin and the war. His tirades against Ukraine stood out for their bloodthirsty rhetoric. "Let us destroy all of the infrastructure of Nazi Ukraine once and for all," he wrote on his website in October 2022. Around that time, Putin took formal steps to annex Kherson and three other frontline regions of Ukraine. Kostyukovich, who oversaw the removal of the children from the orphanage, then became Kherson's representative in the Russian parliament. It remains unclear exactly how Margarita ended up in the care of Mironov in Moscow, but a BBC investigation found in 2023 that the politician's wife, Ina Varlamova, made multiple trips to Kherson to see the girl before her abduction, including at the hospital where Margarita received treatment for bronchitis during the Russian occupation of the city. The BBC obtained documents showing that upon her arrival in Russia, the girl was issued a new birth certificate, which listed her name as Marina Mironova, after her adoptive father in Moscow. Mironov has not denied taking the girl into his home. In a post on social media, he responded to the BBC report with characteristic vitriol, calling it another fake hysteria created by Ukraine's intelligence agencies and their curators in the West. "They have one goal in all this," he wrote, "to crudely and personally discredit everyone who takes an uncompromisingly patriotic position." Reached by Time through his spokeswoman in Moscow, Mironov declined to comment further. He did not respond to specific questions about Margarita. There's a map here that shows some of the areas of Ukraine. Kherson is spelled K-H-E-R-S-O-N. It appears on this map to be in the southeastern corner of Ukraine. That would provide southern ports on the Crimea to Russia. And it's still in red in this map, so that indicates it is still in Ukraine, but it's near the border of the Russian-controlled area of Ukraine. The Russian occupation of Kherson did not last long. In early November 2022, about 2 months after the children were taken from the city's orphanage, Ukrainian forces drove the Russians out. Zelensky soon went to raise the flag in front of the city hall, and he invited me to join him for the ceremony. Kherson and its suburbs had been devastated in the fighting, much of the infrastructure damaged or destroyed. "They cut off all the power, all lines of communication," the president told me during the trip. "We need to restore all that as soon as possible." The mood among the people of Kherson worried Zelensky just as much. They'd been subjected to 9 months of relentless Russian propaganda, which depicts the government in Kiev as a band of fascist thugs. Curriculums in schools had been changed to convey the same message, and Zelensky feared it had taken hold. "I am shocked by the force of this information, the sickness of it." He worried the older children could be recruited into the Russian military, or, as he put it, dragged into the war against us. On the train back to Kiev, the president and his team worked on a set of 10 demands for ending the war. They called it the peace formula. And its fourth point called for the return of all Ukrainian children. "We know by name 11,000 children who were forcibly deported to Russia," he said in a speech November 15, 2022. The day after our trip to Kherson. "Among them are many whose parents were killed by Russian strikes, and now they are being held in the state that murdered them." In total, around 1.6 million Ukrainian children are now living in parts of Ukraine Russia has occupied. They are exposed to Kremlin propaganda in schools, on state-run media, and programs devoted to patriotic education. According to the Yale Research Program, which is run out of its School of Public Health, the kids selected for transfer to Russia tend to be among the most vulnerable, like orphans living in group homes. The researchers found many of the children were taken from frontline regions of Ukraine and placed in temporary shelters before being assigned to Russian foster families. Military transport planes were sometimes used to take the children to Russia. For Ukraine, the permanent loss of these children would deepen a looming demographic crisis. Since the start of the Russian invasion, the population of Ukraine has collapsed from around 41 million people to 32 million, according to official statistics. A UN report published last year projected that by the end of this century, Ukraine would only have 15 million residents. The main drivers of this decline will be knock-on effects from the war, which has killed or wounded hundreds of thousands of men and led millions of women and children to flee as refugees. All of that adds to the sense of urgency Ukrainians feel in bringing their children home. Last year, Zelensky assigned this mission to one of his close aides, Daria Zarivna, who was born and grew up in Kherson, not far from the emptied orphanage. When we met in March, she was especially troubled by the case of Margarita. The statements of the girl's adoptive father in Moscow made it clear she would be raised in an atmosphere of hatred toward her homeland. If we do not give these kids back soon, Zarivna told me, the Russian system will succeed in turning them against us. In December, Zarivna got a chance to tell Margarita's story at the UN. Arriving in New York City, she carried a folder of documents related to her case, including copies of Margarita's original birth certificate and the new one issued in Russia. As Zarivna went over a draft of her speech, she got word Russia was trying to block her appearance. They used every possible lever, she says. Russia's delegates said Zarivna did not have the accreditation needed to address the chamber. The U.S. insisted on giving her the floor, and footage of her speech went viral in Ukraine that day. But it was the Russian reaction that resonated most. Kherson Children's Home, just one case of many, Zarivna said before turning to the Russians in the room. You know where our children exactly are, she told them. The representative of Moscow, a young diplomat named Roman Kasheyev, looked up from his desk, cracked a smile, and began to laugh. Ukraine's Lost Children is this article by Simon Schuster. It is being slightly abbreviated. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.